From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, NATO's Secretary General reaffirms the alliance's commitment to stabilizing Afghanistan. The importance of press freedom to Egypt. Success seizing trafficked animals leads to a new problem. And cyber snatching your personal information in places you wouldn't suspect.
These kinds of programs should concern us just as much as government surveillance programs.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. As NATO prepares to wind down its operations in Afghanistan at the end of the year, its Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made a surprise visit to Kabul Thursday, where he reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to stabilizing the country.
At the end of this year, Afghan forces will assume full responsibility for the security of this country. And I'm confident that they are ready.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is optimistic.
Our desire is for peace and for sustainable peace so that peace will be enduring.
A contingent of about 10,000 foreign troops, most of them American, will stay in Afghanistan after the end of the year to train and support Afghan forces. Thursday on International Edition, we heard Middle East analyst Stephen McNerney speak about the hardships for journalists in Egypt, many being jailed, detained, or harassed. Today, the executive director of Project on Middle East Democracy continues his conversation with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
How crucial to the future of Egypt is a free and open press to allow necessary debate ahead of the parliamentary elections?
No, I would say that it's absolutely crucial. I mean, I think a free and functioning press is essential to the success of any democracy. Unfortunately, Egypt doesn't seem to be moving in the direction of a genuine democracy, and the government's excessive efforts to constrain the freedom of the press is one, you know, one clear signal of that lack of progress toward democracy. If the parliamentary elections are going to be credible, they would have to take place in a much freer environment than recent rounds of elections have taken place. And in Egypt, that environment would have to include a much freer environment for the press than we're currently seeing.
So what can be done to support the freedom of speech in Egypt?
First, it's important to maintain attention on Egypt. Sometimes there's a tendency to focus attention on the worst cases and the worst moments of crisis, and sometimes with the efforts against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria and violence elsewhere in places like Libya, sometimes important developments such as crackdown on freedom of press in other states that might be at least for the moment more stable can be overlooked. So the first thing that I'd say is it's just important to maintain attention. It's also important to maintain pressure, that the international community provide pressure on President Sisi and his government to reverse their current approach of consistently restricting freedom of the press and cracking down on any dissenting opinions in the press. Of course, it's important that Egyptians try to stand up for their rights, but there's only so much that can be done when the government is going as far as this current government in arresting journalists. I think it's important that internal dissent be accompanied by consistent pressure from the outside. We would like to see more pressure from international actors, including the United States government. We'd like to see a clear, firm stand taken regarding the abuses and crackdown on freedom of press. Without a clear reversal of this, I think the United States would be wrong to allow military aid to flow freely to this government. There's a clause in the U.S. law requiring the United States administration to certify that the Egyptian government is taking steps to govern democratically. I think such a certification would be impossible as long as this crackdown on press freedom continues. So there have been, just as you commented on statements from President Assisi, there's also been public statements at the same time from President Obama about the importance of the United States pushing back against efforts to repress journalists in Egypt and other places. So we would like to see the United States kind of back up President Obama's rhetoric with forceful action.
Stephen McNerney, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy. When the Korean War ended with only a ceasefire agreement in 1953, the remains of thousands of soldiers were left scattered across the divided peninsula. In 1996, the South Korean government chose a spot near the demilitarized zone to rebury the bodies of enemy fighters who never made it back home. Reporter Jason Strother visited the site in Panju, north of Seoul, and met a man who says it is his spiritual duty to care for the souls of the deceased.
Alongside the highway that runs from Seoul to the barbed wire fences of the demilitarized zone is an all but forgotten cemetery. And for one South Korean Buddhist monk, it is a truly sacred site. His name is Mukke, and his chanting is meant to ease the suffering of the spirits that haunt this graveyard. His head is shaved, and he wears a gray tunic. He taps on a small drum as he walks past the headstones that dot this hillside. Here rest the bodies of 769 North Korean soldiers who came to fight the South. But the 56-year-old monk does not consider them as enemies.
죽었으면은 다 끝나는 거다. 죽었으면은 모든 걸 용서해 주는 것이.
Mukke says once they are dead, we should forgive them for everything they did in life. This is an old Eastern tradition. Mukke says he did not know much about the graveyard until 3 years ago, when ghosts dressed in military uniforms and with gaping wounds began visiting him during his meditation. They telepathically communicated, he says, and they told him that they missed their families and needed love. After 3 months of repeated visits from these spirits, he began caring for them at the cemetery. At first, he says, he was scared by the ghost, but got used to it. Mukke says these men have not aged since they died, so they still look young. He feels like they are his sons. The bodies of about 400 Chinese soldiers were buried here too until earlier this year when they were sent back home. But the Korean Peninsula's ongoing tensions might mean the North Korean remains will not be repatriated anytime soon. Some North Korean defectors now living here in the South say this is a sad fate for those deceased fighters. Like most other men in the North, 51-year-old Park Geun-ha served in his country's military. He says these stranded soldiers were just doing their job. He says it is a political issue and he would like to see the bodies returned. Park says the soldiers did not choose to go to war. They were sent by their leaders. In addition to the North Korean soldiers that died during the Korean War are a few dozen graves of men who came to fight the South many years later. That includes commandos who tried to assassinate the South Korean president in 1968. According to Korean War historian Andrew Salmon, Pyongyang might not actually want those bodies back.
I can't speak for the North Korean government. This is purely speculation on my behalf, but this was a deniable operation, a black operation. So if they accepted the bodies back, they're accepting that they conducted the operation.
Whatever their reason for coming to South Korea, the monk Mukke says he will continue caring for the North Korean graves until there is finally peace. Even though he has faced criticism from other South Koreans, he says he is doing the right thing. He says people used to ask him why he was caring for the enemy and tried to stop him, but Mukke believes he has changed their minds. Before departing from the cemetery, the monk taps out one last rhythm on his drum and bows toward the graves. Jason Strother for VOA News, Paju, South Korea.
An expanding crackdown in Southeast Asia on the trafficking of endangered species has led to a new challenge: what to do with the thousands of animals rescued every year. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Troe Pong Sop, Cambodia, releasing them back into the wild is usually not an option.
The calls of gibbons resonate across a 2,400-hectare protected forest in Cambodia. The apes are among the noisiest in the menagerie at the Nom Tamal Wildlife Rescue Center. Many of the animals arrived here after being seized by Cambodia's Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team, composed of government officials, military police, and staff of the U.S.-based nonprofit Wildlife Alliance. Every year, the teams rescue hundreds of endangered animals, thanks in large part to tip-offs from Cambodians to a hotline. Illicit commerce of animals is the world's third-largest black market, behind only arms and drugs. It is a multi-billion dollar enterprise involving well-organized criminal syndicates and corrupt or apathetic officials removing species from the wild faster than they can repopulate. At this government-owned refuge is the biggest sun bear population in captivity, in addition to several dozen moon bears. The entire reserve would sustain only a single bear in the wild, says Anuradha Jayasinghe, a technical advisor with Free the Bears. He explains what happened when two of the bears from here were set free after a gradual reconditioning process in another part of the country.
The bears were doing fine for about 3 months, roughly. But then, unfortunately, they both got snared again by poachers. So that's the main issue in Cambodia, is the hunting. It's just the forests aren't safe at the moment for releasing bears. And in the forest, which probably we might be able to, is full of mines.
There has been modest success with other species. More than 2,000 rare turtles, confiscated from traffickers in a cross-border law enforcement operation, were repatriated to their native wild home in Indonesia in February. The pig-nosed turtles had been confiscated the previous month in Hong Kong. In the first half of this year, more than 1,200 pangolins were confiscated, in addition to nearly 4 tons of scales from the animals. The haul was seized from traffickers in China, India, Indonesia, Nepal, Pakistan, and Thailand. At Bangkok's main international airport, there are frequently seizures of 300 to 500 turtles or tortoises at a time. They and other wildlife seized at Thailand's ports end up at 24 overcrowded centers across the country. Most will stay in the centers for the rest of their lives. In many cases, the countries of origin are not known, and those nations would need to request their animals be returned, which does not usually occur. It is not unusual for hundreds of slow lorises to be discovered in a single raid or intercepted airport shipment. Nancy Gibson, founder of the decade-old Thailand-based Love Wildlife Foundation, laments the fate of the endangered nocturnal primates, which are easy to capture in the wild and in demand globally as a pet.
Most lorises have their teeth clipped, so they can't survive if you take them back, or they've been hand-raised, and they're naive little creatures that don't know how to hunt. So there's a lot of difficulties behind that. You have to keep them in the centers.
She says caring for such animals places a huge burden on governments and NGOs.
It costs a lot of money, not just for food. It's also the maintenance of enclosures. And of course, as there's more and more coming in, you have to keep building enclosures. It's a never-ending process. There's a lot to consider because you have to keep an animal and you have to take care of it for the rest of its life. This can be anywhere from 3 years, even to 10 years. And if you have a lot of bird species or tortoises, this can be 50 years.
Putting them in zoos in Southeast Asia is usually not an option because the facilities are overburdened with a surplus of creatures dumped at their gates by people who have tired of caring for exotic pets. Wildlife activist Nancy Gibson explains that many well-intentioned animal lovers tend to purchase such animals on the street, thinking they're helping to free them from deplorable situations.
But this is actually something that is feeding the trade, so you're not actually helping the situation. They will take more from the wild because this is part of their business. If possible, just don't support it at all. Keep reporting it. Whether something actually happens or not, you should always just keep reporting it.
Activists want tougher penalties to dissuade smugglers and find ways to compel countries where the animals originated to take more responsibility for them. Another problem is that many of the kingpins of animal trafficking enjoy immunity from arrest or prosecution due to corrupt officials. That all means the chorus of rescued animals being kept in this Cambodian refuge will have more voices joining it in the future. Steve Herman, VOA News, Tropang Sak, Cambodia.
Long before Edward Snowden's revelations of NSA monitoring programs, privacy advocates have warned about encroaching government surveillance and the erosion of privacy in the digital age. But less attention has been paid to the many ways that private companies monitor, track, and even buy and sell personal information. Now, Harvard-based researcher Adam Tanner is shining a light on the specific ways corporations are using our private information for their own profit in his latest book, What Stays in Vegas. VOA Internet correspondent Doug Bernard joins me now. So, Doug, just what is it that's staying in Vegas?
Well, apart from most of gamblers' money, it's data. Now, Tanner uses Las Vegas casinos, and in particular, Caesars Palace and Harrah's, to tell a story of how corporations buy, sell, and profit from all kinds of personal information. So about 25 years ago, the Harrah's Vegas casino was looking for an edge in what was becoming a very competitive environment. So they took a gamble, if you'll pardon the pun, and turned to a mathematician and Harvard Business School professor named Gary Loveman. Now, Loveman is a numbers guy, and I don't mean in the sense of odds, but in how to use data to keep customers coming back. So Loveman began this loyalty program at Harrah's. Anyone interested in joining would give Harrah's personal information in exchange for participating. So the idea is this. The casino tracks in real time exactly what their customers are doing and how much they're spending. So to encourage people to come back or spend more, the casino gives away these little perks, maybe free tickets, a free meal, a little extra money, that are tailored to the specific customers based on their personal data. That makes customers feel special, so it's proven that they're much more likely to keep gambling.
Well, overall, that sounds pretty harmless.
Well, as far as it goes, it is. Now, remember, it's all voluntary, and it's sort of a win-win. But what Tanner does is uses the casino data program to explore what other companies are doing with our data, but very often without our permission. So one example Tanner talks about are what he calls data brokers. These are companies that have files literally on hundreds of millions of people around the world, very likely you and me. And these files, Tanner says, can be very elaborate and intimate.
These files are available to other companies who buy the information. So it's not available on the internet directly for anyone to see, but they're available for anyone who's willing to purchase the files. And so if they're looking for men of a certain age who might need certain medications or who might be willing or be interested in buying a car in the next 6 months, they can buy lists of people who are interested in that. And that's it. I've been surprised, not specifically what might be on the internet, but with the kind of detailed lists, often very intimate, that could exist for big groups of consumers.
And Susan, here's the kicker. These companies are buying and trading all this very personal information about us completely without our permission, whether we want them to or not.
So maybe these companies know what sort of car I drive or what I like to eat. Why should that concern me?
Well, as Adam Tanner points out, what might seem like random bits of information are increasingly being put together in very sophisticated ways, and these are creating highly detailed portraits of who we are and what we do. He calls it the creepy factor.
So, for example, what size pants you wear combined with what kind of cable television package you have. I mean, if you have a big pant size and you have a very extensive cable television and movie package with all the sports channels, and maybe one or two pieces of information more could suggest you're one big fat guy that's sitting around watching television all the time, and maybe you don't deserve the same health care plan discount or the same banking loan, or maybe there are other things that could be inferred about you, certainly in ways that you had not expected.
So what's his advice?
Well, he really doesn't offer any. He does have an appendix in his book with some suggestions for protecting your privacy if you want things we've talked about here before. But in the end, this book is really more of a caution that says this is going on. It's probably without your knowing it, and it's only going to get worse.
I guess one way to avoid it is not to go to Harrah's or some of these other places.
Well, that
would
be exactly. That would be for that particular program. But remember, these data companies, these massive data companies, are sucking up information from you without your even knowing it. And you don't have the option of opting out or not participating.
That sounds a little scary.
Well, it does. And Tanner specifically says that these kinds of programs should concern us just as much as government surveillance programs.
Wow. Well, the book is What Stays in Vegas by Adam Tanner, published by Public Affairs. Doug Bernard, thanks for your thoughts as always.
Happy to be here.
That's VOA Internet correspondent Doug Bernard right here in our Washington studios. And thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 7th, 1917, there was a coup against the short-lived provisional Russian government of Alexander Kerensky. Under the leadership of Vladimir Lenin, the Bolsheviks seized government buildings in Petrograd, promising land reform, an end to food shortages, and an end to the Russian involvement in the First World War. Lenin crushed all opposition in a bloody civil war that led to the creation of the Communist Soviet Union. In 1811, General William Henry Harrison, governor of Indiana Territory, defeated the Indian tribes of the Tecumseh Confederation in the Battle of Tippecanoe. Harrison would later use his fame over the victory to become president of the United States. He became the first U.S. president to die in office, serving only 32 days before dying of pneumonia. On this day in 1874, Thomas Nast, a political cartoonist for the Harper's Weekly magazine, first used the drawing of an elephant to symbolize the Republican Party. A party supporter, Nast chose the elephant for its great size, intelligence, strength, and dignity. The symbol stuck and has been used ever since. In 1967, Carl Stokes of Cleveland became the first black American to be elected mayor of a major U.S. city. Exactly 22 years later, L. Douglas Wilder of Virginia became the first elected black governor in the U.S. On this day in 1988, the American pop music group The Beach Boys celebrated their first number one hit in 22 years.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya.
Earlier in 1988, the Beach Boys had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On November 2nd, Russia-backed separatists in the separatist-controlled portions of the Luhansk and Donetsk regions organized and carried out illegitimate elections. This vote was illegal under Ukrainian electoral laws, contravened Ukraine's constitution, and violated the September 5th Minsk Protocol signed by Ukraine, Russia, and the separatists. Both Russia and its separatist proxies had agreed to honor Ukraine's special status electoral law when they signed the Minsk Protocol of September 5th, said National Security Council spokesperson Bernadette Meehan. They therefore violated the terms of that protocol with these so-called elections on November 2nd. U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Daniel Baer, noted that while the government of Ukraine and the international community have arduously sought to secure a path toward Ukraine's stable future, in contrast, Russia chose to escalate once again. The so-called election, said Ambassador Baer, marked the initiation of yet another phase of Russia's escalatory, intolerable, and illegal actions in Ukraine. While the Russian Federation may claim to seek a peaceful outcome in Ukraine, the commitments it signs are rendered meaningless when it conducts actions that directly undermine Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The United States cautions Russia against exploiting the illegitimate vote of November 2nd as a pretext to insert additional troops and military equipment into Ukraine, particularly in light of recent indications that the Russian military is moving forces back to the border along the separatist-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine, said Ambassador Baer. We urge Russia and the separatists it backs to fulfill all of their commitments under the Minsk agreements. We reiterate the fundamental importance of safeguarding the stability of Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.